The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 5, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all here. Matt, it's nice that you can sit in the Zendo. Yeah, did you cook that delicious breakfast that we had? Yeah, that was really great. Thank you. Well, I want to thank you all for being Sesshin, this particular Sesshin. It's a weird word, Sesshin. My phone, now that I've been texting people Sesshin, has at least learned that I actually do type that word into my phone. It still doesn't know what it is. It wants to change it to session, as you could imagine. It's a weird word. It's just kind of an odd word. When you're a newcomer, I know, to Sesshin, there's a lot of, what is this? What is this? I mean, what is this? What is Sesshin? And then when you do it for a while, you start to go, oh, I know what it is. I got it. Maybe you do. I don't know. I think I did. I tried to figure out Sesshin. And then you figure it out until you get to the point where you realize, no, yeah, it's better off to, what is this? What is Sesshin? That's what this is. And that's why it's difficult, I think, because it is, what is this? This is the nature of life. This is the nature of the world, but the world we package so neatly into little boxes that we don't really notice it. But Sesshin takes that stuff and just kind of gets rid of it for a while, shakes it loose a bit. So the translation of Sesshin is often, you'll see, collecting the mind. And I think that's all right, you know. I prefer maybe another phrase I've heard in English, which isn't applied to Sesshin necessarily, but settling the mind. And that's all right. But again, it's sort of like, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to settle the mind? What are you talking about? Especially if, and I know this was true of many Sesshins that I have participated in, my mind didn't feel very settled. So settling what into what, right? So Sesshin is really nothing in particular, and because it's nothing in particular, it's really everything, which is, again, what our life is, what everything is that we package into boxes. And that's sort of what this first piece that I'll be talking about today in Buddhism is not what you think. So at Sesshins, most of you are aware that I have been giving talks on chapters from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think, and that's what I'll be doing today again. And the way I do this is we just kind of, I'll read a little section from the chapter we're discussing, and then we'll talk about it. Actually, it'll be a lot of me blabbing at you about it. But that's just the nature of these talks. So this particular piece I'm going to be looking at today is called Canyons in a Cup. And I always like to start out with those titles. Steve picks interesting titles. And this one is interesting just in that it just, if you don't know what he's talking about, it just sounds puzzling, that's all. I don't know that it's suggestive. If you know what he's talking about, if you've encountered a teaching like this, you have an idea. I'm not going to go there yet. But if you haven't, you just look at this title, Canyons in a Cup. It just sounds strange. It almost sounds like a work of surrealism, where they would take two really disparate things and put them together to kind of get you to stop thinking of the world or living the world through your usual ideas of the world. Right? And it sounds like one of those things, Canyons in a Cup, or it sounds Zen. Zen sounds a lot like surrealism in that way. Canyons in a Cup. So what cup are you talking about? Like a measuring cup? Teacup? And what are you talking about by canyons? And how is it that there can be canyons in a cup? And that's it. So that, to me, that's where the title pauses you. Again, unless you've encountered a teaching like this. And even then you might go, well, I've heard of the sun in a sheet of paper before, but I haven't heard of canyons in a cup. So Steve starts out this chapter. He says, Zen practice is about being awake, being aware. But if the point is to be awake, what do we do about it? How do we wake up? And what does it mean to be awake? Aren't we awake now? Huang Po, a Chinese Zen master of the 7th century CE, said, if you students of the way do not awake to this mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought. You will seek Buddha outside yourselves, and you will remain attached to forms, pious practices, and so on, all of which are harmful and not at all the way to supreme knowledge. This is precisely what we do. We overlay our direct experience of reality with our ideas of what is real. And because our ability to do this is so subtle and so highly developed, we don't even know what we're doing. Thus, we become chronically confused. That's quite a pronouncement there. Chronically confused. And that's a pretty good description of the way I think we stumble through life. Chronically confused. Steve says Zen practice is about being awake, being aware. And he starts out and he says, so how do we do that? What steps do I take? That's the way I hear, how do I do that? What are the things I need to do in order to get this awareness? But it seems to me that that question, now it's possible people do that. They go, okay, that's what Zen practice is, that's what I'll do. But my first thing would be to go, wait a minute, what, to be what? What is awake? What is aware? Right. So what even does that mean? Because it's certainly, when I hear it, I don't know, the Buddhism, Plain and Simple, the first book of Steve's I read, has an eyeball on it. So I was always thinking of some kind of cosmic eyeball. It'd be like what awakeness or awareness was. I didn't really know what it was to be awake or aware. And I thought, well, maybe that's, I don't know what those are, but I guess it's enlightenment. But I think enlightenment's almost worse, right? At least with awake and aware, you go, I'm awake right now. I'm aware, right? I think we could say that. We might, if pressed, go, okay, I'm maybe not so aware. But I'm aware. You got to be aware. Otherwise, how can you be here? You know, so that stuff sounds at least like in the realm of normalcy, but enlightenment, I think, tosses it out into a different area. And then it might sound really unobtainable when we've done that, when we've thrown it out of the realm of awareness. Now, as Steve says about being aware, being awake, he says, what does it mean to be awake? Aren't we awake now? That's what I'm saying. Just common sense tells you have to be aware. You know, I've used this example before, but it's a pretty good example of this. You know, you're driving along a familiar car route that you take every day, maybe. And for me, it was a highway, a multi-lane highway. And I could drive on it for 20 minutes without hardly encountering another car because it was on the wrong side of downtown. Nobody was going the direction I was going at the time of day I was going, except for me. And so then I was teaching at the time at a community college, and I'd start thinking about something in my lesson plans. You know, maybe I hadn't quite worked out this exercise I was going to do quite right. I just went, you know, you really kind of left that part. I don't know if you do this, Matt, where you kind of, you came up with an idea, and then you realize sort of as hours are going by later that there's a whole part that needed to get figured out yet, you know. So I'm driving to work, trying to figure that out, or I'm thinking about a student I have to meet with who I know is struggling in the class, and we've met before, and nothing seems to be helping the person get through the class, whatever. And then suddenly your exit's there, and you're all the way over on the wrong side of the highway, and because nobody else is driving, you just scoot your car over, and then you go, how did I get here? Because it seems like I just pulled onto the highway. You know, so how did I get here? Well, you know that you were driving, because otherwise you would have just driven off the road, right? So that's the deal about aware. We know that we're aware. So there's a common just sense notion we have that we know we're aware. And then perhaps we've read other Buddhist teachings that say, you are Buddha. You're already awake. You're already aware. And if that's the case, well then, how is Zen practice about being aware if I'm already there? Which is the heart of the question why practice? That's I'll be giving a class on starting Tuesday night. But this is a question. What do we do? What is this practice then? But all of these questions seem to me predicated on the misunderstanding that awake or aware is something. That it's something. And that it's a particular state. And it's a particular state I don't have. I might be a lot of things, but I'm sure not awake. So that's where enlightened kind of helps you to see that that's how we're thinking about it. I'm sure not enlightened. Or you'll hear students sometimes, they'll say, are you enlightened to the teacher? I haven't heard that in a while, but I do remember hearing that when I first came to Dharmfield. Somebody asked Steve that, and I don't remember his reply anymore. Joko Beck had a pretty good one. It was something like, oh, shoot, now I'm going to forget. Do you remember what she said? I hope I would never have a thought like that. Are you enlightened? You know. So, and what that is something, some place, some state that I don't have. That's where all this is coming from. Because then what we do is we take aware or awake or being aware, being awake, and we make it into an object, which is a mind object. That is, it's something that our minds grab hold of. And I use that term mind because now Steve quotes Wang Po. And now I'm looking at the cover of the book in my mind and I'm not remembering. I know it has a sparrow on the cover of it. Anyone remember the name of that Wang Po collection? It's that boring. The Zen Teachings of Wang Po. That's why I couldn't remember. Anyhow, it's a great book. Every time I read it, I'm just like, whoa. And when I first read it and I didn't really understand it, I still went, whoa, because there's something there. There's Huang Po is one of those teachers. He gets, you know, it's, you feel the wind blowing on your arms a little bit, you know. So Steve quotes Huang Po, who helps disabuse us of the notion that being awake, being aware is some object of mind, right? He says, if you students of the way do not awake to this mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought, right? You will seek Buddha outside yourselves. You're going to be looking for that. There's a lot of words being tossed around here that I'll probably have to tease out just a little bit. But he says, you'll seek Buddha outside yourselves and you will remain attached to forms. And then he goes on including forms here in the monastery, the pious forms, pious practices, and so on. All of which, he says, are harmful and not at all the way to supreme knowledge. So he says, we students of the mind, if you do not awake to this mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought. And that mind, a lot of you have heard the drill before. This isn't our individual mind that Huang Po is talking about. The mind we're awakening to, the mind we overlay with conceptual thought, it's not our individual mind. And then I'm going to add the addendum, whatever that is. Right? That's the one thing we think we know what that is until you start looking at it. You really look at it. Whatever it is you think is your individual mind, you will find that you can't find the edges to it. It's pretty easy to do. I think for me, I first encountered it when I was just thinking about language, because I work with language a lot. I do a lot of writing. Was a literature, teacher for a while. English for probably about 12 years. I did that, 14 years, something like that. So, you know, language is something I paid attention to. Before I became an English professor, though, I was very attracted to surrealism. And I wanted to play some of the games they played. The surrealists liked to have fun. That was a weird kind of fun. To break down their ideas about the world. To try to reconnect with the realism they were calling surrealism, which is the realism not of our mundane dead world, but this other reality that they know is there. Surrealism. And one of the things that they do, they have a game called Automatic Writing. I don't know if anyone's ever tried Automatic Writing, but it's pretty weird. you just sit down at a piece of paper and then you take dictation for what the words are telling you. And you go, what? What words? Well, the words that are always going on in your head. and they're really weird if you're actually just paying attention to what they're saying. They're not saying things like, I went to the deli and I bought a sandwich. And then they're saying things like, the fluid bird sucks translucent eyeballs. It's just like saying these weird things. You're writing this stuff down going, what the heck? I used to try to get my students to do automatic writing, and they wouldn't want to write. Like, I'm driving my car down the road, and I'm like, listen to the language. It doesn't make any sense, but it's there. It's the inexhaustible murmur. It's just this concept. We're immersed. And I started going, where do words come from? And I never thought of that before. I thought when I was making an utterance, that was me. And then you start to see, whoa, wait a minute, where are these words coming from? And where even are the phrases that I'm saying coming from? I'm terrible if I read something or hear something 3 months later, it's coming out in my own writing and I don't even know I'm doing it, right? Not exactly, I don't have that kind of a memory, but just enough of it that if I come back to that thing, somehow I go, wait a minute, I wrote that. And it's so bad that I was going through a collection of poetry that I had, and a poem fell out. And I went, what is this? Now, I write poems. I don't let too many people see them. They're not very good poems. But I write them all the time. There's something about the act of writing poetry that I enjoy, trying to get at it through language and through form, you know, that really interests me. So this poem fell out, and I went, I'm reading it, I'm going, wow, this is good. I don't remember writing this. You know, it was clearly in my handwriting, so I wrote it, but I didn't remember writing it. So I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to submit this to a journal. I've never thought my poems have ever been that. This is fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic. And so I thought, but I don't understand the line breaks I'm doing here, so I'm going to kind of goof around with that a little bit. I was doing that. Just so happened at that time, I was starting to read an old E. Cummings book. It was actually his first volume of poetry called Tulips and Chimneys. And I don't know, it was probably a week into revising my poem. And then I ran across it in the E. Cummings collection. Exactly. I just went, oh, no wonder why it was so good. It wasn't my poem. But I'll do that kind of thing where I'll not know that this has come from somewhere else, because that's actually the nature of this stuff. There really is no originality, so to speak. I mean, which doesn't mean that anyone will ever quite say it the way that I say it. You know what I mean? But we can let that go. That's that stuff about my mind. Right? So what is it when we're talking about my mind anyhow? If we really look at that, we'll see that we can't really pin that down. And that's what mind is starting to get us at. The mind that Huang Po was talking about, well, we start to get into, I don't know what you call this, orthography or whatever, and go, capital M mind. I don't really like that stuff. I don't like having to say capital M, little M, italicize this. It's too cumbersome. So how can we do this in language? Well, let's just not even go there. So this mind is reality. It's another way we could talk about it. But it's not reality the way that we take reality to be, which is, you know, this stuff, which is material, matter, right? That's what we take reality to be. This material or matter, this is actually consciousness. This is consciousness. The breaking up of experience into objects and subjects, into this and that. Into senses, into sense experience, or we could say consciousness is making sense of direct experience. And that's what it is. Consciousness is just making this comprehensible, direct experience. That's it. Making sense of this. It breaks this up into stuff. We're aware. Again, we probably couldn't exactly say what awareness is, what being aware is. But if we're aware of what? Precisely. Right? That's consciousness is aware of what? Awareness is what I think most people call consciousness, which is what this is, awareness. It's not of anything particular. Anything that shows up, it's conscious. You know, it's is our awareness. Anything that shows up is consciousness, which is a working of awareness. Right? Aware of what? Well, right there it is. But it's nothing in particular. Anytime you've got something in particular, now you're talking about this more specific sense of consciousness. Just direct experience broken up into this and that. The making sense of direct experience. So awareness then is, as the way Steve Hagen puts it, lights are on. The lights are on. The lights are on. I don't know a better way to put that. Lights are on, and then what? Right? And then we see things as part of lights are on. But to overlay mind, to overlay lights are on with conceptual thought is to mistake the objects of mind, that is the stuff that's showing up, the stuff that we're looking at, the stuff that has edges to it, the stuff that we understand, with mind, which doesn't have edges to it, can't be understood in that way. It can only really just be experienced. So the way I think of it is this. Imagine a body of water. And on the surface of the water, light is playing on the surface. Just dazzling light. Coming and going. And we get stopped at the light. First here, then it's there, and wherever it was, it seemed to be no trace of it. Then it's here, and that dance of light, we'll call that the ocean, and not aware of the water on which the light appears. It's not a perfect metaphor, but it kind of gets at what's going on when we overlay mind with conceptual thought. It's the same thing. Stuff is appearing, and we get caught up in the appearances, and we think that's the thing. Meanwhile, there's the water on which it appears. Now, it's imperfect because it still seems to suggest an observer that's outside of all of that, that's making this confusion. So we take it right back now to just this and ask yourself, do you move through the world? Do you do things in the world? Or is the world you? How do you live? How do you experience your daily life? So I would just ask that. And again, once we're in the world of things, we are in the world of the conceptual. So how do you move through your world? When we overlay mind with conceptual thought, reality seems to be the world of stuff, the world of this and that, the world of inside and outside, the world of what I have and I know and what I don't have and don't know. And that world, that conceptual world, feels incomplete. It's nature. That's how it feels. Because guess what? If in that world of stuff, how could you ever have everything? Right? What is the Stephen Wright joke? If you owned everything, where would you put it? You know, I mean, in a world of this and that, there are things you can't have. It's just the nature of it. There's stuff that you can't see. Right? Right around the corner. I can't see around the corner right now. There could be, now, I'm not saying it's likely, but there could be a clown dancing just around the corner there. I have no idea. I can't see around the corner. It's a mystery to me. The building might have vanished. I don't know. It's not how it works, but I'm not, you know. All I'm saying is that that's the way this world of this and that, inside, outside, of things you have and things you don't have, things you know and things you don't know, is there's always something you don't have. There's always something missing. So this world feels incomplete, and we feel that. Because we buy this world of stuff as being absolutely true. This is the way it is. And then we feel like something's missing. And it's not all just silly stuff like, well, I don't have a, you know, Mr. Potato Head anymore. And I swear when I was a kid, I had a Mr. Potato Head toy. And I was telling my husband this, where you actually use potatoes and not, you didn't have a plastic potato. Do you remember the potato? Yeah. You just had things you stuck into potatoes, you know. And as a kid, that just seemed really charming to me. Now that I think about it, it seems really weird. Here, children, play with a potato. But anyways, so it's not, it'll feel deeper and more profound than just something like that, some little trinket you don't have. You know, there may be moments where we feel we really are missing something important. We don't have it. And then maybe that turns us toward religion or spirituality. Maybe we go, oh, it's God. God is missing, or Buddha, or enlightenment, or awareness, or awakeness. That's missing. And so what do? Well, we go looking for it, right? Whatever's not here, we go looking for it. And we get it by doing this, doing that, doing some other thing. I don't know. You know, we read books. That's my way. Whew. Boy, is that my way. Here, read books. Or you go to a sesshin. You know, you sit in meditation. Go to talks. Go take classes, whatever. You do that. And then the other part of that is, not only do we do this, do that, and do the other thing, but then we got to do it properly. The proper way to do it. At least this was for me. So when I came here and I learned some of the forms, I immediately then went home because I was suffering from anxiety. So coming here to sit regularly, I had to dollop that out. That had to be like one day a week I could come here. And then the rest of the time I was at home. And when I'm at home, I'm doing exactly in my little office area what I'm doing here, or trying as close as possible, because that's the proper way to do it. So whatever it is I'm doing, that's the way I got to do it. And then maybe, while you're doing it, say we're talking with Huang Po, then maybe some old feeling arises. You know? Seriously, when I read Huang Po, it's one of those things. The first Buddhism book I read, first Zen book I read, was Alan Watts' Way of Zen. And I read that, and there were things in it, and I just went, oh my God, oh my God. You know? So maybe you feel something like that, and you go, that's the thing I'm missing, right there, whatever that is. And there we go, it's a feeling. To think, and then we get caught there, right there on the surface, the dazzling lights on the ocean. And Steve says, well, this is precisely what we do, right? We do it well. We overlay our direct experience. Well, how does he put it? He says, we do this, we have an ability, he says, it's so subtle and highly developed that we don't even know we're doing it. Isn't that it? It's so subtle and so highly developed that we don't know we're overlaying our experience with conceptual thought. We just don't know we're doing it. You want to know how fast it is? Just walk in any room. It just happened. Do you know what I mean? Boom. A whole thing just happened. Faster than the speed of light. Well, probably speed of light because you're looking. we're using our senses to make sense of what it is that's going on. And then we grab hold of that in this way. We have an idea about what's going on. And then that idea has built into it a whole bunch of judgments about what's going on. Evaluations, feelings that we have. That's it. Boom. Just happens that fast. And then we act out of that. We don't even know we're doing it. We're really good at it. Especially we've been trained to do this. But we catch on pretty quickly. And then, not only don't we know we're doing it, we don't believe we're doing it. You know, so I could take a different example than just walking into a room. You know, if you think about like moral values, you might say something like, torture is wrong. I can't even imagine somebody saying torture is objectively wrong. It's objectively wrong to torture. And of course, then if you go, well, I don't know about that. It sounds like you're going, well, there are times when torture's okay. Well, it isn't necessarily what that means. It just means, well, why is torture some kind of an objective category that you're going to be now drawing? I'd say if you talk to, let's say, a mud puddle, just a mud puddle, probably torture isn't even in their universe, you know? So how objective is that in the first place? But again, that's the kind of stuff. Stuff that just seems like it has to be true. We don't realize what we've done. Now, I think somewhere in my talk, I'm going to bring this out again. But I do want to make sure it's clear that what I'm not saying then is that we shouldn't conceptualize. In fact, I know I do have this in here somewhere, so I'm going to wait, right, till I come to that. But it'll sound like that. You'll go, well, conceptual thought. It sounds like he's saying that's bad, but that's ridiculous. How am I, if it's as simple as walking into a room, how am I supposed to get rid of that, right? Nobody told you to get rid of it. There's something we're doing with it. That is the problem. So when we overlay our life with conceptual thought, when we overlay mind with conceptual thought, reality, we just don't see what's going on. We're missing out. It's like when I was doing that drive to work. Yeah, I was driving, but I sure didn't really. Like, I probably would have had to go under deep hypnosis to be able to tell you what had happened on the drive. I had no idea. So I was so busy working out my lesson plan or talking to my student. Steve says, take any object, a mountain, the sky, or an everyday object like a teacup. Our usual way is to think, it's just a cup. Often we know the object so well and we size it up so quickly. And that's what I was talking about. We know teacup. We know what we think about teacup. We do it so quickly, we ignore it almost entirely. We make ourselves a pot of tea and blindly fill the cup with no thought and barely any awareness of what we're actually doing. We do this because we know, we believe it's just a cup and nothing more. But if we really pay attention to what's actually experienced, it's not just a cup. If we look, we can see the whole universe right here as this cup. Inside this cup, as the Sufi poet Kabir would say, are canyons and pine mountains. The cup doesn't appear by itself. Someone took clay and fashioned it, and someone made that potter's wheel. And there's the tree that fueled the fire for the kiln, and the sun and the rain and the soil that grew the tree. When we see that all this has gone into the picture, we can then actually experience a cup. We can see the cup for what it is, which is to say that it really isn't anything in particular. Right? So again, what Steve is describing is how we move through life. Just we're familiar with these objects, we're familiar with what we think about these objects, and we don't really see the object itself. We don't really see what's there. We don't see that the object isn't quite the object that it seems to be. And we believe that we know what's going on. We just believe it and just assume it to be true. Often in doing that, so we think about a teacup, for example. I don't know, you know, I don't have a lot of teacups myself. I have coffee mugs, though. And then there are the coffee mugs that I like, and then the coffee mugs I'm kind of indifferent to, you know. So, you know, you could get the coffee mug you're kind of indifferent to. Isn't that weird? I mean, there are actually coffee mugs I like and then coffee mugs I'm just kind of indifferent to. So I get one I'm indifferent to and maybe my heart sinks a little bit because I was like, oh, I thought I was going to get the one with the electric fetus logo on it and I got this blue one instead, you know. So there we go. Then our heart sinks a little bit and then what we're doing is we're missing the miracle that's taking place right in front of us. And we're dismissing it as mundane. Missing in that the miracle of the mundane. Right? And by miracle, I don't mean something magical, you know, or something extraordinary. I just mean, you know, I looked miracle up because I knew it was the right word, but I also knew that I had a lot of stuff that I didn't really agree with. Its etymology, the Latin etymology of miracle is mirus, wonderful. Mirari, to wonder. That's what's missing. I was just talking to somebody the other day. The sun was in their eyes and they're going, ah, it sure is bright, you know. Thought, I really appreciate the sun. And I went, what a great thing to say. Because usually we're just caught up in the everyday thing, you know, just like, oh, hey, pull the blind or whatever. But this person, as they were squinting and doing all that, just also had to put in their appreciation of what it was they were seeing. And so when we dismiss that mundane coffee cup, the coffee cup we don't want, you know, we miss the whole universe that's right there in this cup. And, you know, as Steve points out, we can actually start to glimpse that the whole universe is showing up as that cup when we just start to ask ourselves these questions. So Steve's got these questions, you know, someone took the clay and fashioned it. And you're ready to go, well, what's clay? You know, so now you're getting some other processes, geological processes that are involved. And then someone took the clay. Oh, there's a person there. So where'd that person, how'd that person get here? Well, that person has parents, right? And their parents have parents. And their parents and so on and so on and so on, right? And then you get, suddenly if you just go back a few generations, you got 500,000 people involved in bringing the clay to, you know, to fashion it into a cup. And then someone made the potter's wheel. Oh, there's another someone, another 500,000 people if you go back so far. They made the potter's wheel. Oh, what's a potter wheel? Is it going to be made out of stone? Where did they get the stone? What kind of stone? What went into making that stone? And how did it turn into a wheel? And yeah, how'd the shape of the potter's wheel come? What is a potter's wheel? When did they invent? You know, there was a moment where I asked myself, as I was going to sit on my quadrillionth chair, I don't know how many chairs I've sat on in my life, but it's a lot, you know, and I just went, you know, somebody invented a chair. When did they invent the chair? And I actually looked it up. And it goes back a long time ago. I can no longer remember because I just don't have a brain like that. But let's just say it was a really long time ago where they have the first chair. And let's face it, if today this thing is like, I don't know, 20,000 years old, I don't remember how old it is, but if they have that chair now, there were probably chairs that preceded it, right? So, but it has a beginning, right? This object showed up somewhere and then it gets passed. It's the same thing with the potter's wheel. So then you start to see all, again, all that goes into the stuff you take for granted. And you start to see the limits of your beliefs. You start to see the limit of what you take to be true. That's what beliefs are. We just take something to be true. I believe that's true. And again, if you're paying attention, if you're seeing the limits of your beliefs, then in everything you encounter, you can see that what you take to be true about it is limited, provisional, and partial. And then, if that's the case, you can start to relax your grip on your beliefs about the world. If you're really seeing that, you can start to relax your grip and open yourselves up to what's really there. Open yourself up to what's really there. It's a wonder. And as Steve points out, it's nothing in particular, right? He says that cup. It really isn't anything in particular. Steve says, try to nail down what anything is. You can't. It's like trying to answer the question, is that you in your baby picture? What can you say? You may say, yes, that's me, but obviously it is not. You're not a baby. But can you say, no? Who is it in the picture then? And if you say, that was me, how could you still be you if you're six times bigger and far more articulate? Indeed, what does you refer to? And if you say, it's both me and not me, what can this mean? Have you ever seen anything that both is and isn't what it is? And if it's neither you nor not you, what are we even talking about? If we really carefully look, such simple everyday questions as these can set our minds spinning. Well, if you've ever tried to nail down what anything is, as Steve puts it, to say definitively what something is, you know how difficult that is. I mean, I've done it in my life. You just try to say, that's what this is, you know, and it applies to simple things. It applies to complex things. I think about when I was learning how to be a composition instructor many, many years ago now. There was an exercise that was recommended that we give our students on the first day of class. And it was to have them describe putting a nut on a screw without using the word screw or nut. And it's not that that's impossible. It's just you start to see that when you don't have the concept to narrow down your reality, it becomes a little more difficult to pin down. So something that simple is difficult. But when we start getting into the more difficult questions, right? When we start making pronouncements about the world, which, you know, I used to be expert at that. I'm still pretty good at it. Something happens and you go, oh, well, I know what's going on there. This is what, you know, if these people only saw this, they would, you know. And if anyone ever pushed back, and most of my friends would, because I was very free with my opinions. So they'd get pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and I'd get pushed into these corners, and I could realize that I had no idea what the hell I was talking about anymore. But it would make me so upset that I would just keep going. I would just keep going, you know. I'd say, I am not going to capitulate. I'm going to win, you know. But what I was really seeing when I did that was that I really didn't know what I was talking about. And now when I start doing that, the wind gets sucked on my sails pretty fast. I'm usually like, oh, look what you're doing. Yeah. So Steve gives us that example. We've heard it before if you've taken any classes with Steve. But that example of the baby picture, right? And I like that one because it's something we're familiar with. And it really does make clear that conundrum, because you look at that baby picture and you know, and somebody shows you a picture, baby picture, you go, that's me. You know that that's not really you. You know that. And all the way Steve just said, you know that that baby's not you. And yet, we also intuit that, well, that is me. You know, but it's not me. Because, you know, if you were to say, well, that's me, we know we're not saying we're the baby, but we're not saying we're not the baby. So there's a strange thing when you're looking at that baby picture where you can't really say it's you and you can't really say it's not you. And that place is the helpful place. We think it's to say, well, I'm not the baby anymore. And then you get, again, I've seen some debates. I don't remember, Matt, if you remember, but I remember being in some of the foundation classes and somebody calling Steve out on the baby picture, you know, because it'll sound like he's saying the baby's not me. But he's actually pointing out you can't say either way. Reality just ain't going to let you do it. And again, so what we start to do is see that we grip. We'll say like, well, that baby's me, or that baby's not me, and we grip. And then we close out everything that's not, everything that's outside of the grip that we have. I'm now thinking of G.I. Joe's kung fu grip, you know, we got that grip on it. And when we do that, whatever it is we grip, that's what we see. You know, so it's blocking everything else out. So once we start to, again, loosen, we start to see, oh, we're just, this isn't the way it is. This is the way I'm just saying it is. If we allow ourselves, we can loosen that grip and we can be open to what it is that's really showing up. And if we actually look at the, you know, just taking Steve's example, and we start looking at other paradoxes that show up in our lives, other puzzles that show up in our lives, same thing. Rather than dismissing them as nonsense, which I think I did a lot in my life, you just kind of be like, something weird would happen, you'd be like, well, that was weird, but you know, the weird stuff you don't pay attention to, right? The exceptions to the rule you don't pay attention to. That just was a fluke. So you got a word for that? We got a lot of words for that. It was a fluke. It's not a real thing. It was a fluke thing. This is really what's going on. So we look at the averages, the way it's supposed to be. And we're getting to supposed to be in a second here. So we can start looking then at those quandaries and realize, whoa, life has these paradoxes, these quandaries, because it's not really the way that I'm taking it to be. And you can start noticing that you're grabbing hold of your ideas. Steve says there's absolutely nothing about our objects, absolutely nothing absolute about our objects, I mean, ever. Even though we usually think there is, we quietly assume a cup is a cup, is a cup. But where can, oh, by the way, talking about that bigger than us, we know where that is, right? That Gertrude Stein showing up as Steve Hagen, but a rose transforming into a cup, and there you go. A cup is a cup is a cup, but where can we draw the line between the cup and everything else? If you pay very close attention, you'll see that you can't. Anything you can package in your mind, anything you can frame and divide from other things is a concept. And confusing our concepts with reality is what gets us into so much trouble. Once again, I'll just stop there. It gets us into so much trouble. So the first thing Steve says is there's nothing absolute about our objects. And it's that word absolute that you want to pay attention to. There's nothing absolute about our objects. But we think our objects are absolute. What are they? They're absolutely there. I mean, we don't run around going, I know this to be absolutely there. We just, that's just, it's nature. It's absolutely there. And if you're to question it, then you might get an ashtray thrown at you. Like that philosopher, I don't remember which philosopher it was, Richard Rorty maybe, that Errol Morris threw the ashtray at because he thought that the guy was denying the reality of the ashtray, so threw an ashtray at him. But usually somebody like that, philosopher's not saying the ashtray's not real, he's just trying to say it has a certain kind of reality to it, right? We think that that reality is absolute, absolutely true. And that's where we get back to the material. So whenever you start talking about this stuff, people will be like, whatever it is. You know, they'll, Samuel Johnson, right? Isn't he the one about kicking the stone? You know, yeah. You know, you kick a stone, you just stub your toe. Seems pretty real, you know. But it's that absoluteness we're talking about. Absolutely the way that we think that it is. Now, I said we don't explicitly do this. We don't run around going, this is my absolute take on the world. Remember, Steve was talking about how subtly we do this. It's very subtle. Here, he uses the phrase, quietly assume. Just quietly assume. Quietly because we don't go, I'm now assuming this, but we just assume it. And as my husband always points out, because I think a shop teacher had said this to him, what do when you assume? You make an ass of you and me, right? Why? Because when you're assuming, it's not necessarily true. You're just taking it to be true. And that's the absoluteness of this stuff. We take that to be true. So the cup is absolutely the cup. And then we don't see the canyons in the cup. The canyons in the pine tree. It's just a cup. And then there's of these cups. You know, I have ones that I like and some that I don't like so much too. You know. So then you go, you evaluate it, and you go, okay, well, it's that cup. Okay, well, and I don't like them because one of them is hard to drink out of. That's really the main reason I don't like it. But there you go. I mean, that's what shows up. Now, you notice, I'm not telling you I don't have preferences, right? I could care less which one I get. I mean, I shouldn't say I could care less. Just for a moment, I'll be like, oh, that one. That's a deal with drinking out of that, you know, but that's all right. Then I drink out of it, you know, that's just what you do. But you still have preferences. They're still showing up. So what are you doing with those things? You still have ideas, but does this have to be absolute? Do I just treat this as something if it was the, you know, one I didn't like, for example? Do I push it away? Like a kid at a meal they don't like? So my husband told me that when he was a little boy, he didn't like anything. He didn't like eating anything, you know, so whatever he was served for a meal, didn't like it. Stuff that I loved as a kid. He's like, no. I think about all he liked when he was a kid is peanut butter. He liked peanut butter sandwiches, which he still really likes. And so what he did is, you know, he would not eat and then parents would scold him and make him sit at the dinner table until he ate. And then he'd finally, after many tears, he would finally eat just to get it over with. But apparently his sister was almost as picky an eater as he was. But she wasn't going to capitulate. So she would just not eat it until it went on so long that the parents would finally just dismiss her. So Todd's like, here I was eating these horrible things that I didn't like, and my sister got away with it all the time. But that pushing away, right? That's what we do with the stuff that we don't really care about because we're not paying attention to, again, the miracle of this. Sun's in my eyes, but I still appreciate it, right? The cup is. You know, I recently was on a flight, an air flight. I took a trip, real short trip to Miami. And as I'm taking the tram back to my flight back to the Twin Cities, I was thinking again about, you know, I feel guilty. I didn't own a car until I was like in my 40s, you know. And so when I fly, I just think about the exhaust that's being pumped into the air. And, you know, I mean, I just start to feel guilty. And I was thinking about, what's the toll this is taking? And we have a planet on fire. And, you know, and then I started looking as we were on the tram at, because I was just, that's all I was thinking of was the exhaust, you know, the cost of this flight. You know, was this worth it? I mean, I had a good time, so yeah. Don't think I'm complaining about the trip. Even though I did get caught in a flash flood, it still was an adventure. You know, but it was a good trip. But what I started looking at was, as I was coming in, all these vehicles that were parked in the parking lot of the employees at the airport, and then we went past that, and there was a whole area. I mean, it was, in its own way, it was really quite beautiful. It was like all these yellow cabs just in this one area. And I went, look at all those cabs. And then luggage conveyor things that you would, you know, and there were just a collection of them. All of this was like looking at some kind of an art exhibit, you know. And these things were just all over. And I started noticing all of this. And then I started thinking, oh, my God. Like, I'm just thinking about my air flight, and there's actually all of this stuff that's here that is part of my ability to be able to fly. And this stuff isn't even the stuff they're using, you know. And then I started looking at, you know, then you look at the metal and you start realizing all of it starts showing up, and you realize how precious everything is. So I didn't dismiss my flight. I just became way more appreciative of everything because all that went into my being able to complain about the, you know, people at the TSA line, you know. I actually didn't this time because I really, really got a sight of it coming in. Really went, oh yeah, let's not get caught up in the object of your scorn, you know. Let's just open this up and really realize the miracle of all this, that this is even happening is pretty incredible, you know. But it just shows you that everything you have, think about all that went into it. Everything. It becomes a little harder to just discard things casually when you really pay attention and you really realize what this is. The whole universe. The whole universe. There's no exaggeration right there in that cup, in any object of mind. So when we take these as being absolute, we lose that, and it just becomes a cup. That's just a cup. Steve says, anything you can package in your mind is a concept. And I think this is really important. Now, this is where I was talking about before. This is important to realize. As you said, remember, Wang Po told us, he said, if students of the way do not awake to this mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought. And then I'm just going to dot, dot, dot. All of which is harmful and not at all the way to supreme knowledge. Right? So then we get to anything you can package in your mind as a concept, which is important to realize because what Steve is not saying is that we shouldn't conceptualize. What Steve is actually saying is you can't help but conceptualize. You can't. Right here we are. This is a ready conception of direct experience. Conceptualization is taking place. You can't help but conceptualize. because this world of appearance is a world of concepts. It's what we conceive. It's what we can conceive. And that's what we ultimately can't do with reality. That's what when we start looking at, we try to explain things, it starts to get out of our control. We can't explain it. And that's because reality isn't our concepts, but we conceptualize. So again, we just want to see we're doing that. See that you're conceptualizing. So we don't usually get that. We don't really see what our concepts are. We don't see, we generally see our concepts as reality, as absolutely real. But the deal with concepts is they can't encompass reality. They can't fully know reality. And that's where the problems arise. Again, we just have ideas. We think we know what they are. Familiarity might be part of it. And we act out of those ideas. And then we're acting, I don't know, at odds with reality. We're actually not. You're just acting out reality. But it's you're acting out a different reality than what's actually showing up, or you think you are. As Steve says, once again, the question becomes, how do we wake up? First of all, you have to want to wake up. But wanting to wake up is not like wanting a new car or a new job or respect or love. If you really want to wake up, these other things are irrelevant. To want in this way is not, and he's talking about to want to wake up, is not ordinary wanting. If you want to wake up to how the world really is, you must be totally open to this, the reality of this moment, even while knowing full well that you can't conceive of how it really is. Waking up can only come about through seeing, not through coercion or the application of will. It requires a willingness to let go of all our cherished opinions. To seek enlightenment as though we expect some kind of payback is only to frustrate ourselves. If you really want to wake up, then just wake up. That's it. If you really want to wake up, just wake up. So as Steve says, the question becomes, and how do we wake up? This is the first question he asked us when he told us what Zen practice was. How do we do this? Well, he said, first of all, you need to want to wake up. And this is important, because if you don't, this is pretty hard. It's just not going to be fun. So you're going to have to want to wake up. And as Steve points out, it's not our usual sense of want, because our usual sense of want is the sense that we have that something's lacking and we want it. And remember, that's the world of this and that. That's the world where it seems like something's missing all the time. So it's not that. And actually, if we look at that sense of want that something is lacking, if we really look at it, and I think Steve gives us some examples here, a new car, a new job, respect or love. You know, if we look at these things, you just imagine a new car. Maybe you want a new car because it'll give you prestige, or maybe you want a new car because you're sick of taking your old car into the garage every 3 months and having to pay $1,000 to $2,000 for repairs, and you're saying, I need a new car. You want a new job because the one you have just sucks so bad, and you can't stand that manager, and you'd rather do anything right now than see that person's face again. Whatever it is, you know, or love. Well, I feel really lonely. I really need someone to love right now, right? So all these things are things that we can understand. They're all based on our sense of lack of how things should be, right? So I don't have this thing that I should have. My car shouldn't be something. I just looked at my car, by the way, which is an old car. And it has some kind of, I don't know my terminology, but I was telling Todd this. I said, it's like my car has a lacquer on it. And the lacquer's peeling off in one spot now, which is really pretty alarming, because I assume now that bad things are going to happen where that's occurring. But it just happens to be up above a spot where there's a frighteningly large amount of rust. So I bought the car used, and it was pretty old when I bought it, and it was pretty amusing, because what the guys did at the place I bought it from is they just spray painted over the rust as if you couldn't see there was a bunch of rust there that they just spray painted black over, you know. So anyhow, it's like, you know, I do see that there's rust there. I'm a little concerned about that. All right, we'll take $500 off the car. All right, you can get a deal. But our sense is that my car shouldn't be rusting, right? So we have ideas about the way things should be, Right? Again, that's that lack. Life should be like this, and it's not. So then I need to do something. I either need to change the world so that it's like it should be, or I should change myself, or I need to acquire something. But this waking up, this wanting to wake up that Steve's talking about. So our usual way of wanting, again, is life's not the way it should be. The way that Steve's talking about this wanting to wake up is to want to wake up to how the world really is. That's different. That's a whole different animal. And as he says, it's to let go of all your cherished opinions. Not our cherished opinions. And I'm not kidding. We have them. We have opinions that we do not want to part with. Maybe they're what we identify with, but my guess is we think they are the truth and we will not. I mean, that's the thing where you double down then. But you have to be able to let go of that, to loosen your grip on that. That's wanting to wake up, to let go of our ideas, the conceptual overlay, and let life in. Again, it's like a closed hand. We're letting everything in by opening that up. We're letting everything in. To want something other than just reality as it is to invite frustration. It's a thing we think is going to cure our frustration, satisfy us in some way, and it's not. It's just going to invite more frustration. Steve says, start paying attention to your object. So remember now, he's telling us, how is it that we wake up? First of all, he says, you have to want to wake up, and it has to be that other kind of want, not for what's missing, but for what's really here. You want to be able to let go of your cherished opinions. And usually you only get to that place, I shouldn't say usually, but often you only get to that place when you're pushed in a spot where those cherished opinions don't make any sense anymore. And you go, yeah, I can't sustain this. I can't do this anymore. So the second thing he says is start paying attention to your objects. Notice what you're thinking, believing, conceiving, what you're constructing in your mind, and start to notice how baffling and contradictory and pervasive the constructions of your mind really are. Once we really understand what's going on, we're less likely to hang on to our cherished opinions because we can now see that everything we pick up is like water trickling out between our fingers. We know we're not going to get too far with our mental constructions before they fall apart and no longer work. The universe is not mysterious. Reality is clearly displayed at all times. Nothing is hidden. But for our thoughts, we would see it. The true path is meeting your eyes even now. The true path is meeting your eyes even now. Just attend to what is actually going on and keep it simple and keep it clear. Just open your wisdom eye and see. So just pay attention. You want to wake up, to the world as it really is. Just pay attention to your objects now. Just pay attention. Don't start a running commentary. Don't start to analyze what's going on. Just pay attention. See if you can resist gripping the objects that come before you. Because remember, when we do that, then we're closing out the whole universe. The whole universe is showing up at whatever objects it is you're seeing. That's just the nature of reality. When you grip them, when you grab hold of them, you can't see that. You can't see it. It's incomprehensible. And we can see this in the meditation hall, right? Objects are going to start to arise and cease and arise and cease. We see them arising and ceasing, and we grip hold of them. And then suddenly, you'll be sitting just a few feet from the wall. And you don't see the wall. It's like you don't see the wall at all. And you know you do. It's like me driving my car. There's the wall there, but you're not paying attention to it at all. You're in a conversation, or maybe you're imagining something. You know, some people have very visual imaginations. And it used to be over here, I'd see a it's in a pattern in the wall, but I'd see a cartoon duck with a sombrero smoking a cigar. And whenever I do that, I'd be like, got to move your eyes, because it's just you're putting some dots together there. And then that's it. And then that becomes it. That's the whole thing, right? So in Sesshin, we can start to pay attention to the object. We can see them forming. We can see us gripping them. We can see all that happening. Or not. Or we can see that we're in the middle of doing it. That there's the duck, you know, so there now, there's the duck. So now, in noticing that, you're actually noticing what's taking place. Before that, you were just playing with the duck. Now you're noticing, oh yeah, I've got a mind object. You don't have to say anything. You just notice. And once you've noticed it, now you're back here. Right back where we started from. Right back where you always are. And only when we do that, only when we open ourselves up to what's actually here rather than our ideas about it, then, as Steve says, you know, then we realize that anything we pick up, and that includes our opinions or ideas about things like water trickling out between our fingers, we can start to realize the fluid dynamism of what this is. Every moment. And how the objects of our mind, how our ideas about them only go so far. You're just going to see that. You'll be aware of that. And again, Sesshin is a perfect opportunity to see that. Because the ideas just wear themselves out after a while. I mean, I still remember back in the day after Sesshins, I would look at a fellow Sesshin sitter and I'd go, oh, how'd it go? You know? And the problem with Sesshin is you can't, what is Sesshin anyhow? So what does it mean? How did it go? But I was still in that stage where I'd have some really awful ones and I'd have some really great ones. And, you know, and so, and I remember this guy just looked at me and he had like, his eyes were just dark pits and his hair was kind of tousled. And he goes, I've been stuck inside my head for the last 2 days. How do you think it went? And I said, oh, sorry I asked, right? They're only going to take us so far, and then they exhaust us. And when you're exhausted, you know, can you set it down? And I think about when I was when I was a kid, and we had to pick our band instruments. And I think I was in the fourth grade or something like that. I was sick that day. I mean, my heart set on being a saxophone player. I don't know why. I didn't start listening to jazz till I was in college, but I had my heart set on playing the saxophone. And then I was sick, and I came the next time I could talk to the band teacher a couple days later. And he said, well, what instrument do you want to play? And I said, saxophone. And then he kind of, his whole body kind of sank a little bit. And he said, well, we already have 20 students. When I grew up in a really small town, by the way, so 20 students would pretty much be 90% of the band. Because we already have 20 saxophone players. We don't really need another one. And not only that, but my family couldn't afford to rent an instrument. And the school had one saxophone, you know, so I couldn't do it. And I said, well, what do you need? And he goes, well, we need tuba players, trombone players, and baritone horn players. And I was smart enough to know in the fourth grade that a tuba was way too big, you know. And my older brother played the trombone. There was no way I was going to do what my older brother was doing. So I played the baritone horn. And you all know what a baritone horn is. You just don't know that you know what a baritone horn is. Because every time you see a movie and they have a marching band, a guy playing a baritone walks past the movie camera. Always. My husband gets tired of this. I go, there's a baritone, you know, because they're just an instrument most people don't know. But I'm telling you all this because a baritone is still like a tuba. It's like a miniature tuba. And I had to carry that thing to school. And we lived, I don't know, like a mile away from school, so 15, 20 minute walk, carrying this. And sometimes it gets so heavy, I just couldn't, my hand, I could just feel, my fingers just didn't want to hold the handle anymore, and I just have to set it down, right? It's the same way with our objects of thought, same way with our ideas. They get so heavy, they get so weary, set them down. That was relieving to do that, to set that horn down and just get my hand back and set the idea down, let it all come in. Because as Steve says, the true path is meeting your eyes even now. And we talk about straying from the path. You really can't. Straying from the path is just when we get ideas about what we're doing. And then it seems like we've strayed from the path. And then what do? We just come back to this. See this. Whatever it is. In other words, no matter what it is, it's showing up. See this. Keep it simple, Steve says, and keep it clear. I'm going to leave it at that because the last thing he says is a little weird, but just keep it simple. Keep it clear. This is a simple practice. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it's very simple. I mean, just let it be simple and just do the assignment, which is what? Just to be aware. And how do we do that? You want to be awake. You want to be aware. You pay attention to your objects. That's it. Pretty simple. Everything else is mucking around. And that's okay. If you're mucking around, notice you're doing it when you're finally there. Go, oh yeah, look, I'm mucking around. Don't scold yourself or anything like that. Just notice it. Because now you're back here. Because now you realize what you're doing. All right. That's it for today. Do people have questions or comments?
Yeah. One exercise we were talking about, it was like in the context of like surrealism and that writing exercise that you're describing,
yeah,
where you write your thoughts. Seems to me that would be pretty difficult. Like, wouldn't like, and I have a genuine question about this, I'm yeah. curious, like, wouldn't the intention of like writing down your thoughts corrupt the process? Like, how can you actually write down your free-flowing thoughts?
It's a discipline, yeah. But you just have to listen. You really just have to get out of the way and listen. And what'll happen with the surrealists would have little techniques they would use to help them keep themselves from starting to turn it into conceptual thought. So if you had to keep a pace going. You had to keep that pace going so you couldn't stop. You couldn't like think about the next thing. You had to just listen and write and listen and write. And I had to go fast. So you had to write, give yourself cramps basically. And if you paused and you stopped right there, and the next sentence maybe would start with the letter V. And you'd just start listening again until you paused to think, and then you'd stop, and then the next sentence would start with the letter. And they'd either use the same letter or they would have a collection of letters to start and stop. But that's it. So it is a little bit of a trick. It's why my students couldn't do it. You know, I didn't realize it was that hard because I've been doing it for years, you know, and then I was like, come on, everybody, this is fun. And they were like, this is terrible. Why are you, I don't understand what you're asking me to do. So, yeah, but if you can get out of the way. I mean, you are writing, you are doing something. But is it you writing? That's the question. And in the 1920s, you know, kind of when they were doing this, actually, there was another way that this was seen, and that was that it was people transcribing voices from the other world, you know, the other side. So you get those too, like visionaries or seers would use the same writing technique, and then they'd be channeling some person from the other side, you know. But it's the same idea. Where is that actually coming from? Where are these words coming from? The reason they thought that or could say that is because it really wasn't them writing those words down. It was the words themselves. And syntax, I mean, it is very rooted in your culture, you know. So it's like that Noam Chomsky sentence, furiously green thoughts. Do you remember that one? Furious green thoughts do something, you know, and then you just start pulling it apart and you go, what's a furious green thought, right? And I have no idea. When you tap into the flow, it doesn't create meaning. It just kind of recreates the syntax and the vocabulary. So when I write, a word will pop into my head and I'll be like, what the heck is that? Honestly. Or I'll be like, I think it means this, and I have to look it up. And sometimes it's spot on, and sometimes it's absolutely the wrong word. But then if I sit and think about it, I realize it rhymes with another bizarre word that was in my head that is the right word, because it just got filed in there somehow, somewhere. And it wasn't my fault. I just read it. So, yeah. I recommend trying to read that stuff, you know, just to see what it's like. There's a section in the Manifestos of Surrealism called Soluble Fish. And you don't have to read much. Read a paragraph of it. It'll frustrate you, but you'll kind of get a handle on what it looks like. Anything else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.